supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you this week, cats and kittens. When we get to the question of the week, we will talk about how to protect your most precious plants from either a late frost or a warm winter that has a sucker punch coming at the end to take down your flowers. We're also going to talk to one of our favorite people, Dr. Lee Reich, not about pruning, not about fruit trees, but about drip irrigation. Lee is a man of many talents. But before that, we're going to take your talented phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Catherine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Catherine. How are you?
I am good.
And where is Catherine good?
I'm from Jenkintown, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
You got it.
All right. What can we do for Catherine in Jenkintown?
Well, I was really excited when I read about saving pepper plants that you were talking about on the show, and you had it on your website. We had some lovely bell peppers this summer in our first attempt at gardening. They were all in pots. So we brought them in for the winter, and they did great for about a month. They were even getting new blossoms and putting new peppers out. And then a little bit after Christmas, we started with massive infestations of, I think, two different kinds of these bright green little bugs, and the plants are not looking so hot anymore. I'm not sure how to get rid of the bugs or if it's worth trying to save the plants.
Okay. One of the things we always warn, and it should have been really highlighted in any articles you read of ours online, is that even though you can't see them outside, aphids love to colonize pepper plants. For people who don't know what we're talking about, pepper plants are perennial in areas that don't suffer a frost or a freeze. So if you bring them in the winter, you can put the same plant out over and over again. And if you get good at it, and you're very careful about cleaning the plants off before they come in, and you got the right conditions inside, there's no reason you can't have plants that are 8, 10, 12 years old. And as they get older, instead of just a little green stalk, they develop a woodiness that makes them like small trees. And they tend to lose their leaves down low, but have this amazing canopy. They're almost like loblolly pines with fruits on them. So it's amazing. But you really have to take them to an in-between area early in the season. Don't wait until it's about to get really freezing cold out. You want to start bringing them inside in mid-September in our area. Bring them to an in-between place where you got a garden hose, put on the nozzle that delivers the sharpest stream of water, and then just blast every leaf. Now, you're going to lose some leaves. You may lose some flowers. You may even knock off a pepper or two, but don't worry about that. You want to blast every leaf structure, every underside, every little crotch, and you want to leave it outside to settle down. And then a couple days later, you want to repeat this, and then you want to wipe down the inside of the pot and the outside of the pot with a wet rag. I'll bet you that you'll see little bug bodies on that rag when you're done, because most of the pests are on the pepper, but some of them are hanging on the sides of the pot. And then you bring them inside, and what are you doing for light for them in the wintertime?
We set up some shop lights in our basement with fluorescent lights in them.
Oh, good. But the plants are not completely dead yet?
Not completely dead, but some of them are getting pretty close.
Okay, but, you know, we're also starting to get out of winter. So what I'm going to suggest to you is, if you can do it indoors, if in your kitchen sink you have one of those rinsing sprays, you know, one of those attachments,
yeah.
It's not ideal. It's not the highest pressure, but it's a pretty good start. You could start by taking the plants and rinsing them off. If that's too cumbersome, get a pressurized sprayer, which you can get at any garden center, hardware store, home center, and you put water in it, you pump it up. And then if you have to hang like a towel behind the plants to protect what's behind them, don't worry about that, or, you know, have a helper hold a piece of cardboard behind you. but then cradle the plant with one hand and use the pressurized sprayer to really clean them down. At this point, all you're trying to do is keep knocking down the aphids until we get to the end of May and the plants can go back outside again. If there's any life left in them when they go back outside and you keeping the aphids under control, even if you don't eliminate them, they will immediately put on new leaves, they will flower, and they will produce fruit before any store-bought peppers.
Great. Yeah, we will do a better job. I think we were not nearly as thorough as we needed to be, it sounds like.
Sometimes neither am I, Kath. I mean, I've been doing this trick for 25 years, and some years I get nailed.
Well, this is great. I'm looking forward to some excellent peppers this year.
I think you will get some.
Thank you so much, Mike.
All right, good luck to you. 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you. This is the inimitable jardiniere Mike McGrath, yes?
Yes, it is. And where is John?
I'm in Philadelphia. I'm tucked into Fairmont Park, which I might say is actually the largest inner city park in any city in the country. Our good fortune here in Philadelphia. And I'm awash in pachysandra, azaleas, rhododendrons, akubas, holly, junipers, all these acid-loving plants. I'm shrouded in a beech maple grove, very mature beech maple trees. And I recall during earlier programs, you kind of alluded to not using fertilizer on established trees and shrubs. Not preferring the granular fertilizer. And so my question is really where garden spikes work best and when, if at all, because I'd like a quick and easy solution that I can do what's necessary to maintain these plants and at the same time not have to go through bathing in the blood of the lamb, so to speak, to fertilize them.
Well, I mean, the easiest thing for you to do would be to trust in the plants, John. I mean, you are, as you say, in Fairmount Park, which is indeed the largest urban park system in the world.
That's great.
Yes. Are you in the part that runs through Center City, Northeast Philadelphia? What section of the park?
It's in the western part of the city along the Wissahickon, along Lincoln Drive.
Oh, what a beautiful area, heavily wooded. And have you noticed forest sprites of any kind running through all those natural areas with little concentrated salts shaped like spikes, banging them into the ground of the trees?
No, but I know that. You're talking about the identification spike.
No. I'm saying nobody feeds the trees in the hardwood forest.
Nobody
fed the Great Plains. Nobody sprayed the statewide fields of wildflowers. These plants have evolved to live without our help and often live longer and happier without our help.
But most of these shrubs, like azaleas and rhododendrons, of course, are like Caesar salad for the deer, and so I have to protect them. And sometimes they get compromised when the deer eat them, and you're hit with a bit of a drought, so they start losing their leaves prematurely. So I'd like to be able to do something to those smaller type shrubs.
The worst thing you can do for a plant that's been stressed is to feed it. That will finish it off. If you really want to protect these plants, there are devices, large and small. There are repellents that you can use to try and keep deer away. But obviously in Fairmount Park, if you've got azaleas and rhododendrons, that's a deer's salad bar. You don't want to feed them because chemical fertilizer spikes will cause fast, lush growth of plants. And that's the type of growth that is softest and tastiest and most attractive to deer and insect pests. If you need to rehab them from an eating the best thing you could do is have a big brick of milled peat moss around and a big pile of compost. And if you see a plant doesn't seem to be the right color or it got attacked, just mulch it with an inch of peat moss covered by an inch of compost, and that will reacidify the soil, put some soil life back at the root system, and help the plant survive. But the last thing that plant needs is for you to be banging concentrated urea into the ground. The only thing you can do is make sure they're getting lots of light and air. There aren't a lot of whole leaves or other mulch compromising their root system, depleting the flow of oxygen to the roots. And if you want to do something nice for them, peat moss and compost, not any kind of chemical fertilizer.
Okay, that's really helpful. I appreciate it, Mike.
All right, good luck, John.
Bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, March 15th. This year's show runs from March 11th through the 19th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philly, and again with me on stage live at 4 o'clock on Wednesday. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Drippy Lee Reich, Frozen Fruits, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a lot of people did not get apples or peaches or other tree fruits last season because we had the warmest winter in history. And then it got really cold at the end when the plants were flowering. Same thing that happens with a true late frost. We'll tell you what you can do to try and protect your plants against both of those evil menaces. We're also going to take more of your menacing phone calls. But now it is time to welcome our special guest, Dr. Lee Reich, who joins us with an unusual topic. We generally talk about fruit trees or pruning or something. And Lee wants to discuss drip irrigation. Drippy Lee Reich, welcome to You Bet Your Garden again.
That's a new name you've given me.
Yeah, there you go. Try not to live up to it. Now, a drip irrigation is a very hot topic, and I'm often surprised that people in areas with adequate rainfall use drip irrigation. Most of the market gardeners and small-scale farmers I know grow in hoop houses and high tunnels, and that gives them protection from the elements, but it also prevents them from getting rain. So even though they're in an area, like here in Pennsylvania, we get 52 inches a year, they need to run drip irrigation lines into their greenhouses.
Well, even outdoors, it's really necessary if you want to get maximum production. Even though we get about 50 inches of rain a year, the rain isn't always falling at the right time. Say if you average 4 inches of rain a month, if you get 3 inches of rain 1 week, 3 weeks later, the soil is going to be dry. You know, for intensive growing, if you really want to get the best production, you do have to water. And in my opinion, the best way to water is with drip irrigation.
And of course, if you're in a dry climate, it's absolutely essential. Because not only do you need to water, but you need to water efficiently and with the least amount of water and money involved.
Right, because if you're in California, basically there's no rain at all between May and October. So you have to be pretty exacting in your watering.
When we talk about drip irrigation, we're talking about a number of different things, because the water source could be a giant rain barrel or a cistern. Or out in the West, it could be a gray water system. But in most cases, it's going to be well water or city water in a pressurized system.
Right. That's correct. You know, one thing just to say quickly about using a rain barrel, it's a great idea. But for most drip irrigation, there are some special systems where you can run them at very low pressure. So drip irrigation works at low pressure. But if you use a rain barrel, unless it's elevated quite a bit, it's not going to provide enough pressure for drip irrigation, because basically you need about 10 pounds per square inch of water pressure, and you get about a half a pound for each foot above that the water's raised. So basically you'd have to have a rain barrel 20 feet high if you're going to be watering something on that level.
So we've got a water source. And then the lines. There are a variety of things that I would consider a drip irrigation, which would include lines with little holes in them and hoses that kind of sweat the water out. No, okay, well, I'm asking you what your definition is.
Well, true drip irrigation consists of tubes with closely spaced holes in them, or it could be just a solid pipe where you actually punch in the emitters. This is not just a tube with holes in them. These are what I like to say is engineered orifices, which for some reason makes people laugh.
Yeah, I'm trying to, you know.
Anyway.
Enjoy saying that
right,
too much.
So the engineered orifices, they actually are self-cleaning, so that if some particles do get into the system, they sort of flush themselves out. And also, most importantly, that all along the whole line, the water output will be uniform. So whether even with some variation, incoming pressure, beginning of the line, end of the line, you know, in farm fields, they'll go hundreds of feet and you'll get the same half a gallon per hour or whatever it is at the beginning of the line as at the end of the line.
So these are actually, quote, miracles of engineering.
Right.
Then.
And
nothing
I know
you could do by punching holes in
right,
a leaky hose.
Definitely not. Or by having them ooze out of some porous rubber material. And it's not something, though it sounds very high-tech, it's not something that's expensive.
So a really well-engineered system, I presume you would link it together. You'd have different sections, some sections that would remain dry and some that would water, so you could connect everything?
It depends. If you have widely spaced plants, then you do want to keep certain sections dry. In between the plants, you'd no reason to water them. This is one thing nice about drip irrigation. It saves typically about 60% in water, and one reason is because you're not watering places where the plants aren't growing.
You mentioned that you cover this topic in your book, Weedless Gardening, and one thing I noticed at my friends' farms is the absence of weeds, because they really are only watering the lanes where the salad greens, the tomatoes, the peppers are growing. And the rest of the soil is too dry to support a lot of weed growth.
Right. The nice thing about it is, so when the water enters the soil through drip irrigation, it doesn't go straight down. It also, because of capillary action, the soil goes sideways, but it doesn't go sideways right at the surface. So it's sort of like an ice cream cone shape if you picture the soil.
To match the plant's roots.
Well, not only that, but also right at the surface, it's not wetting the surface except right where the drip is occurring. So if it's only wetting the surface there, the rest of the surface is dry, so it's not stimulating weed growth there.
Now, we like to give plants 1 inch of water a week, preferably in a normal climate, all at once, so that the plants can dry out in between. But I would imagine with a drip system, we might be running it more frequently.
Well, you definitely run it more frequently. And, you know, people always, because traditionally people have used sprinklers, and the way to use a sprinkler correctly is you water, as you said, once a week, 1 inch, equivalent 1 inch depth a week. And then what happens right after you water, the soil's flooded, so the roots can't really take up water. So gravity has to pull excess water out. Then there's some air and water in the soil. The plants like it. Then they get a little dry. Then you water again. Drip irrigation is totally different. What you want to do is you want to add a little – you're actually trying to replace water at about, ideally at about the rate at which plants use the water. So say I have a timer, because you want to have a timer. You don't want to be running outside.
No, you can't. You'd lose track on third day.
Right. So I have a timer that can go on 6 times a day. And in my book, I went through this complicated calculation of how to figure out, for any type of system, how to get that equivalent 1 inch depth per week spread over 7 days, spread over the amount of time your timer can go on per day. Anyway, to make it simple, it's like 20 or 30 minutes a day. So say 30 minutes a day, my timer can go on and off 6 times a day. So during daylight hours, I have it go on 5 minutes each time every 2 hours for 6 times a day.
Now, one of the things we tell people, especially with lawns, not to do that, because if the surface of the soil is constantly moist, the roots have no reason to go deeper into the soil, which is what establishes a healthy lawn. Is the drip irrigation system different? It's not encouraging shallow rooting with that frequency?
It actually is encouraging shallow rooting, but that's what you want. First of all, because in the shallow layers of soil is where there's most biological activity, most fertility. So you want that. The thing is, if you do that, you don't want it all of a sudden tell the roots, the plant roots to go deeper, because by the time that happens, the plant will dry out. So drip irrigation, you have to keep it up through the whole season. But if you do that, you promote the shallow rooting, which really promotes healthy plant growth.
In a certain type of plant, not in a lawn.
A lawn also, shallow roots wouldn't be bad as long as you were constantly there.
Yeah.
But in a lawn, you wouldn't want the lawn to be wet every 2 hours during the day.
Yeah, exactly. So that seems like a lot of watering, but it's not a lot of water, right?
No, because each emitter, the emitters might be a foot apart, but each emitter along the line, typically it'd be a half a gallon per hour, and in 5 minutes, that's very little water.
Now, are you ever sending anything else through the lines? Are you feeding through this or anything like that?
Actually, people do this. But to me, that's sort of contrary to the whole spirit of organic agriculture, where you feed the soil.
Right.
Microorganisms break down organic matter in the soil, in so doing, releasing nutrients. So I think, if I had emergency treatment, I would do that. But hopefully my garden would never need that.
The reason I ask is, especially back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, we used to get a lot of inquiries about running compost tea and manure teas through drip systems.
I'd say just put the manure or the compost on top of the ground, rain waters it into the ground, and then the plants get the food.
Now, what about rain, Lee? We've got this timer set up, but I presume that we're growing out in the open. We're not in a greenhouse or a hoop house or a high tunnel. How do we account for rainfall?
Well, I have a very high-tech way of dealing with this. I turn off the drip irrigation if it's rained a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I take a Post-it and I put it on my bathroom mirror that says drip.
Right.
And this reminds me, because I'm always afraid of that, I won't turn it back on. If it's raining a lot, I'll turn it off. If not, my soil is very well drained, so I'll just, a day of rain, I won't bother to turn it off, then turn it back on. Although you can buy, they have these soil moisture sensors that can actually turn the timer off when the moisture's at a high enough level.
When we would talk about drip systems or soaker hoses for people in really dry climates, we would often talk about covering the lines with some sort of mulch to maximize the amount of water. Is that a good idea, totally unnecessary, could cause problems?
Well, when I put in my first drip irrigation system, I actually buried the lines, you know, a couple inches deep. Unfortunately, it was sort of like striking oil. You know, I'd go into the garden with a trowel and all of a sudden hit this line, and then water would come up. So now I keep all my drip lines on top of the ground. I run the main lines that bring water to the drip lines. I've covered them with mulch. But the drip lines, besides not wanting to make holes in them, it's also nice or very important, I think, every once in a while to check the lines. You know, make sure, you know, walk up and down every row, make sure that there's actually dripping. Sometimes, you know, things go wrong. They get clogged or the line comes off from the main line. So it's good to keep an eye on it.
You garden in upstate New York. I garden in rural Pennsylvania. We often have adequate, if not too much, rain for most of the year. But typically, if we're going to get a dry spell, it's going to be in July and August.
Right.
Is it worth having a drip system that you're only going to use 2 months of the season?
I think so, just because, you know, a lot of people have smaller gardens these days, and smaller gardens, doing the right things, you know, how you plant, intercropping, succession cropping, all that, but also with drip irrigation, you can get a lot out of a very small area of land if you do all these things, which includes drip irrigation.
And are you only watering during the day?
Yeah, because plants use water during the day. And as I said, my goal is to replace water as plants use it, ideally. Obviously, that would involve a very, very, very slow drip throughout the whole day. So, but, you know, I approximate it with six times, but just during the day.
All right. Well, our guest has been Dr. Lee Reich, who has a standing offer to join us in the studio anytime he comes into Philly, which he does with great regularity. If you'd like to read more about his drip irrigation ideas, you'll find a lot of information in his book, Weedless Gardening. Lee, always a pleasure to have had you on the show.
Great to be here again.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Michael. I have to tell you how much I enjoy your show. I'm not a gardener, but I do love blueberries and blackberries. And my concern is we've had some hard freezes already. My bird bath froze over. And I'm looking at my skimpy blueberry plants, and they've got buds on them. And I was planning on pruning them. Is it too late?
Now, where are you, Steve?
Charleston, South Carolina. The weather since the hard freeze has been very mild.
So you're in luck. I have a friend with me in the studio today, Dr. Lee Reich, who is a renowned fruit expert, author of several books on fruits, and I know he's a blueberry fanatic. It might be his favorite fruit. So, Lee, tell Steve from Charleston what you think he needs to do.
Well, first of all, it is my favorite fruit. So when you say buds, you don't mean the buds are opening. They're just swollen,
no,
and obvious.
They're just little growths right now. They're kind of red, and they're actually at the base of existing leaves.
Now, Lee, when do you typically prune blueberries? Because they flower kind of late, right?
Yeah, well, I would prune blueberries about the same time as I would prune most dormant deciduous shrubs, and that would be after the coldest part of winter is over. Of course, you don't get a very cold winter down in Charleston. So
we've had hard freezes, and it'll probably freeze again hard. So that's the dilemma I'm in. I don't know whether to prune now or wait.
Well, you can't go wrong by waiting. I mean, you could prune any time up to when growth begins. My blueberries are totally unfazed when the temperature gets to be 20 below zero. So,
but Lee, what I think Steve is saying, and I think this is important, because I warn listeners in the D.C. area about this all the time, is if he's in the middle of a warm spell and the plants break dormancy and he prunes them then, is there a possibility he's going to stimulate new growth that would be harmed by the next freeze?
That could happen, although probably the plants won't grow now no matter what. I would just to make sure, I would wait to prune. Plants won't start to grow until they've experienced a certain amount of winter. So they probably have not experienced that amount of what's called chilling hours yet. So it probably won't grow, but just to make sure, you can't go wrong waiting.
And Lee, what is he pruning for? I always like to go into that.
So with blueberries, as with other shrubs, you want to prune to get rid of old wood, to have so you have young, more fruitful wood, and you want to open it up so you get more light into the plant. But how old are your blueberries?
They're a couple years old, and I actually had production last year. I mean, like most of June, I could go out and pick blueberries for my breakfast cereal. So I was very pleased with last year's production.
Well, I think I solved your problem, because until blueberries are 6 years old, they do not need any pruning at all.
Oh, terrific.
And the reason is because blueberries produce the best fruit on stems up to 6 years old. So once a plant's 6 years old, then it has stems that are older than 6 years old. So you prune away those older stems. But you're not going to have
that
yet.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad I called. Excellent.
Well, all right.
Thank you so much, Mike, and I enjoy your show. And I guess I was fortunate I got two experts today.
That's right. For the price of one, Steve, you can't go wrong. All right. You take care, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, March 15th, at the Master Gardener's Spring Symposium in Fayetteville, North Carolina on March 25th, and in beautiful State College, PA, April 6th through the 8th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with a look at frost-free fruits and more of your frost-free phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in a little bit, which fruits are safest to grow if your area, region, or just this entire planet is experiencing late frosts or warm winters that have a cold spell at the end? You can lose an entire season's crop when that happens, and many people have. We'll tell you how to try to walk around that issue after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Matt, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing just ducky, thanks.
Oh, you stole my line. Where is Matt Ducky?
I'm in Gloucester City, New Jersey.
The Garden State. All right, what can we do for you, Matt?
Well, I have a question I'd like to kind of put in like a pea gravel patio that will kind of act as a mulch around a big old Norway maple I've got in my backyard. The area is not huge, but the roots do kind of come out of it. They don't come up into the ground, but they flare out a bit. My worry is if I put the pea gravel down, it does, you know, it gets hot and it holds the heat. Am I going to cook this tree or how can I screw this up, you know?
Well, oh, a million different ways, man. As soon as we start messing with nature, Norway maples are, you know, they're not the best trees. They tend to be brittle. I'm sure yours has been dropping branches every once in a while if it's a big established tree. But they're nice. They're maples. They have beautiful color in the fall. And a lot of maples will develop above ground roots. Now, whether that's because the roots are fat and we see the top of them more than other trees, or whether they're, you know, they have this ability to lower the soil line around them, the best answer to make a safe walking surface and to do something that looks nice is to mulch them, quote unquote, with compost or topsoil. And that will hide the roots, give you a level surface. And then, it, believe it or not, it will be easier to control any weeds in topsoil or compost than it will in gravel. Do you have any existing gravel around?
Well, we do. We have a pea gravel patio that's up tight against the house, and we put some landscape fabric down, and we've got probably 4 inches of gravel, which would be too much to go, you know, on that tree. But that's kind of what we were going for, you know, to be able to put a table or something or some chairs over there. When you mulch with compost, does it dry out on top like a regular, you know, would it be messy still
It tends on the season, and it tends to be related to the type of compost. But here's what I'm thinking. Now, how long has your pea gravel patio been established?
3 years now.
Okay. Aren't you starting to see some weed incursion in it more?
No, we haven't had any.
Okay, because what's going to happen is as time goes by and little bits of schmutz get down there on top of the landscape fabric, you're going to have weed seeds blow in, and then they're going to establish down in the gravel. So it's probably not a good long-term solution. Your plan makes a little bit more sense now. I wouldn't put the landscape fabric anywhere near the tree, near the roots of the tree. If you wanted to do it, I would just level things out with compost or topsoil and then put a couple of inches of pea gravel on top. But, and I don't know what your budget is like, but this also sounds like an area that once you get the roots nicely covered with some compost or topsoil, might be a candidate for some true hardscaping.
Yeah, I think that's the plan. We have it's kind of an urban lot behind our house, and it's sizable, you know, because it's surrounded by row homes. But we're going to do our first butterfly garden back there in raised beds, so it's going to have some area build up around it. And actually, I started those seeds already for the perennials, all native things to our area.
Yeah, but for sitting and for tables, and you probably have learned this already, or having a gas grill there, pea gravel is almost like being on a moving ship in a storm. I mean,
I get that.
Yeah, it's not a really flat surface. And hardscaping in the right situation can be an excellent solution to give you an outdoor area. And if you wanted an option, you could do the compost and topsoil. You could put down some pea gravel. And then have you ever seen these decks that are very low to the ground, that are literally only like 6 inches off the ground?
Oh, yeah.
But they can provide a nice flat surface, and then you haven't created any impervious surfaces either. Water can still drain through that and get to the roots of the tree. And if you have it built correctly and installed correctly, you know, you may be able to swap it out, move it around in the future if your needs change.
But that's a nice idea.
That's where my thoughts are with your situation.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Good luck, Matt.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Hank, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Hank. How are you?
I'm very good. How about you, Mike?
I am just ducky, Hank. Where are you very good?
South Jersey, Egg Harbor City.
All right. What can we do for Hank in Egg Harbor?
Well, I was really interested in hearing the interest in pawpaws. South Jersey has an overpopulation of deer, and I've read that deer don't eat pawpaw plants.
Right.
Pawpaw contains a toxin, and it seems to be a similar synergy like that of the monarch butterfly and the toxic milkweed. So this is a great IPM. I see you're educating people to IPM on your program. And so this is a really good IPM way to deal with those nasty deer.
Right. IPM standing for Integrated Pest Management.
Pest Management.
Looking for ways to control problem insects and herbivores and diseases without turning to toxic chemicals. Now, I want to back up a bit and remind listeners who may have missed the show that you're referring to a great interview we did a couple of weeks ago with a guy named Andrew Moore from Pittsburgh, who has written a great new book on pawpaws. And
Right. There
has always been interest in this Native American fruit. And in my conversation with Andrew, one of the things we kept going back to is, as you say, these plants are deer resistant. They can grow in the shade. They don't need as much sun as other fruiting plants, although, as he pointed out, you'll get more fruit from plants in full sun. And they can grow in relatively wet soils, which only makes sense because a native plant like this has long been adapted to growing in the northeastern forests of America.
Right. This is the second year of my quest to grow pawpaws. I bought a couple pounds of seed. The seeds are really large. It ends up I had mixed results. I tried planting some in the woods. After putting them in the refrigerator for 3 months in a bag, plastic bag with some peat moss, and I took them out in the spring, and I planted them in soilless potting mix.
Right.
They did well there. I tried planting them out in the woods where we just have that forest mat, that shallow layer of topsoil and then sand. And they didn't do well in the woods, but they did really well in the potting mix.
Right.
It took some patience. They didn't come up for about a couple of months. It came up in the heat of the summer. They popped up, and now I've got a bunch of little pawpaw whips that I'm going to be planting out real soon.
Well, and as you know, however, one of the things Andrew warned about was those plants are going to take 7 or 8 years to produce fruit because you're growing them from seed. I would encourage you to keep your seedlings going, but I would like to see fruit earlier than that if I were doing this. So I think you might also want to buy some mature plants that are grafted that have, you know, that the top portion is known to produce really good fruit.
Yeah.
So that you'd have some experience with the harvest and the handling by the time your little baby plants produce. Because I don't know about you, but I'm not planting anything for 8 years from now, right now, at this point in my life.
Well, it sounds like I'm at about the same stage, but it's hard to find plants. There's a few sources. They're real expensive. I did find some out at Lawyer Nursery out in Montana.
Now, wait a minute. You're in South Jersey. I would try to find a nursery closer to your region. I would be looking for a nursery more in the New York, New Jersey, Delaware, Northern Virginia. I would do some searching. I would scout around and then, you know, get some going, have some fun, enjoy some of the fruits because you have to learn how to work the fruit. And, you know, if you have some small harvest coming in from a couple of purchased trees, then you'll be ready when you're when your seedlings come in. And, you know, don't forget that you will also be breeding butterflies because this, the pawpaw is the host plant of the zebra swallowtail butterfly. So once you get a lot of plants in the ground, your property is going to be covered in butterflies at certain types of year.
That's really great. Well, thanks for giving me an opportunity to share with the discussion.
All right. Well, thank you for bringing up that book again, Hank. That was a great interview. The book is Pawpaw.
Yes.
The author is Andrew Moore. And my understanding is it's coming out in paperback right now.
Okay.
All right.
You're a great company.
All right. Thank you, Hank.
Keep up the good work. Thanks, Mike. Talk to you later.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, how not to lose your fruits to frost. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with this week's question.
Sure, Mike. Charles in Vernon, Connecticut writes, first of all, love your show and can't thank you enough for your efforts. Keep it up forever. Now, I've been vegetable gardening for 7 years and have had a place of my own for 3 years now. On that 1 acre, I have raspberries, blueberries, red and black currants, red and black elderberry, choke cherry, gooseberry, serviceberry, apples, pears, pawpaw, etc. I'm wondering if you can steer me towards fruiting trees and shrubs that are less susceptible to being blasted when a warm winter is followed by a, quote, normal cold snap at the beginning of spring. That's what happened to a lot of us last winter, 2016. And I can only imagine it will happen more and more often. As I plant more of my acreage, I would like to concentrate on crops that set their fruit later.
Yeah, and you know, we should note that the subject line on Charles's email was battling climate change. And his concerns are certainly valid. A warm winter can, and like he says, just did, set early blooming plants up for a knockout punch in the spring.
But it's not the same thing as a, quote, late frost, right?
Absolutely right. Now, this is a good opportunity for me to repeat my warning that you just can't garden by the calendar. The, quote, last average frost date assigned to your growing region is just that. It's an average. Some years you'll be frost-free long before that date, and some years it'll drop into the 20s 2 weeks after that date. That's why I always urge cowardice in putting tropical plants like peppers and tomatoes outside. The smart money says to wait on that until the nights are reliably in the 50s.
And if you ignore that advice with tomatoes and a late frost blows through, you can easily replace those plants. But if a late frost blasts the flowers on, say, your peach trees...
Which is exactly what happened last year, except that it wasn't a late frost. The plants were blooming way ahead of schedule because what turned out to be the warmest winter in history had lured them into opening their flowers much too early.
And there's no replacing those flowers at the garden center.
No way. That's why crop failure is the scariest phrase in farming. You invest a lot of time and energy into your trees, then you get zero return that year. Okay, now we asked our resident fruit growing expert, Dr. Lee Reich, for his advice on this topic. And on the very same day, I emailed Charles to tell him we were going to answer his question in depth. Their responses practically arrived together and confirmed some basic truths. Lee wrote, "We're mostly talking about fruits that bloom the latest in the spring. Persimmon, raspberry, blackberry, and elderberry come to mind. Also, some fruits like cornelian cherry and pawpaw have frost-resistant blooms. And finally," says Lee, "I've never lost a crop of blueberries, even on my frost-prone site, and even last year."
And Charles said something similar?
Remarkably similar. He said that he harvested a lot of raspberries and a good number of blueberries and black currants, all small fruits and all later blooming than fruit trees like apples and pears.
Well, aren't there, quote, late-blooming varieties of those?
Absolutely, and they are good choices for growers in the north. Now, they're not going to be late-blooming enough to be any kind of a guarantee. but you'd be foolish not to choose those varieties in a chilly region. And this always brings me home to this point. Gardeners, don't pick a variety just because you like it in the supermarket. Grow the things that are best for your region's climate and resistant to your local pests and diseases. We will also note that Charles reveals he's only been on his property for 3 years. So if he planted all these fruits, you know, they're still small and getting established. But last year's losses, again, were not his imagination. I tried to keep one of my blooming peach trees going by moving our gas grill underneath it and running it on low all night with the lid closed.
That sounds clever.
Ran out of gas in the middle of the night. But I did save a different tree that was much closer to the house by hanging an old string of incandescent Christmas lights in the branches, which worked perfectly. We got a really nice crop of peaches from that tree.
He might have to haunt yard sales to find old non-LED Christmas lights.
Or go rummaging through the neighbors' attics, but it's worth it. Lee also mentioned that you could drape row cover material like Rimae over the trees, which would also help prevent frost from forming on the flowers. And that brings me to some final bits of advice. One, make sure any new trees you purchase are dwarf or semi-dwarf in size so that you can do things like light or cover them easily. Two, if you really like the light 'em up idea, plant those new trees close enough to the house that you can safely run extension cords out to them. And three, be sure to plant any new fruit trees in your areas of highest elevation, not down low in the pockets where frost will form first. Well, that sure was some interesting information about the fruits with the lowest risk of frostiness, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to put my fruit flowers in the frigid air if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please include your location, oh please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to send us. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website frost-free. Always warm, Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Frosty the editor is our own Al Banks. Our intern, Michael Inglés, is finally not wearing a tie to the studio. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. I'm going to see if I can find one of my old Catholic high school clip-on ties before I see you again next week. What can you expect to hear next week? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I have no idea what we're going to do, only that it will be fun and that I will get into trouble. Plus your fabulous phone calls.